Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description. All right, I've got two different articles I'm going to touch on today. The first one is a bit of just a climate observation, along with some anecdotal evidence. And the other is an interesting report that comes out every year from actuaries in the UK, looking at their view of the future based on their models for the impacts of climate change on humanity from a GDP perspective, as well as from a deaths perspective. So super fascinating. We're going to look at both. We're going to start with this article out of the SanFranciscoGate.com titled "Scientists Concerned as Joshua Trees Bloom Months Early in the California Desert." Joshua trees normally start blooming in February. This year, the bloom started in late October. It says a single Joshua tree's ability to reproduce relies on several precise actions all happening at exactly the right time. First, the Joshua tree's branches flower, then the yucca moth. The one and only pollinator for the Joshua tree must find and pollinate those flowers so that they can produce fruit. And finally, once the fruit has fallen to the ground, rodents snack away, dispersing the seeds far and wide. But this year, Joshua trees throughout Southern California have bloomed early, potentially disrupting this precise timeline. Scientists aren't sure yet what caused the early bloom or what the impacts will be on the tree's ability to bear fruit, and they're asking the public to help solve the mystery. The early bloom is the latest concerning news on the beleaguered, threatened Joshua tree, which is struggling to keep up with changing conditions, wildfires, and extreme weather driven by climate change. Joshua trees typically bloom in February and April, according to Jeremy Yoder, an associate professor of biology at California State University, Northridge, and principal investigator at the Yoder Lab, which focuses on the co-evolution of interacting species, such as the yucca moth and the Joshua tree. And by the way, I've obviously been using the very American pronunciation of yucca. In Spanish, it would be yuca. Now, one person mentioned that this has happened before with these Joshua trees, but in a very small, confined area. This year, however, it's happening in a much more widespread manner across California. These trees are sort of historically beloved trees. I personally have to admit, I don't know a lot about them or their history, but I do know I hear people talking about all the time that they are sort of iconic in California. Now, it's talking about how this moth has to be present in order to pollinate the trees, and unfortunately, those moths are not going to be around in the wintertime. The fear is that if these Joshua trees are blooming too early, they miss that window in which those moths are around in order to pollinate them. There is the potential for the cycle being offset in such a way that it could hinder the growth and spread of these trees in the immediate future. Now, some of the commentary around this was posted to the rCollapse subreddit, and the poster said this: "While not the most dramatic or dire effect from climate change, this serves as a very visible sign to both scientists and volunteers. Joshua trees are already threatened by things like wildfires and, of course, climate change in general, so expect their ecological niche to be further eroded as collapse continues." That observation that, like, okay, Joshua trees, their survival is not what's going to determine the future of humanity on Earth. But these types of observations that are happening to other species right in front of our eyes are critical to understanding the pace and rate at which the climate is changing and the effects that it's having on the natural world. Some of the anecdotal evidence in the comments were things like this commenter who said, "I own a bunch of timberland in the Pacific Northwest, and not only are wildflowers starting to bloom in January, I am losing trees to strange funguses," and I assume they meant fungi I have never seen before, "and literally have 100-foot trees falling over from it. I assume that former winter cold kept some of this stuff at bay, but it's been 40 to 50 degrees and sunny instead of teens and covered in snow. As a tree farmer, this is really, really not good." Someone else said, "I live in an area in the Rocky Mountains that is already hugely effed by pine, spruce, and fir beetles that haven't been dying back in winter due to warmer temps. And now we have had 2 years in a row of hardly any snow and cold. Our poor forests. Also, the Colorado River is going to be low this year, and I still have green grass in some spots on my land in February, in almost February. Another responder said, also here too in Colorado, worried about water levels, and my plants survived the winter without really dying like they normally do. Another commenter talking about in the Pacific Northwest, their little blueberry bushes are starting to bloom, and they're also noticing heavily wooded places where they live that are plagued by rot in the trees. Another commenter said, down here in Ecuador, we have arupo trees that typically bloom during the dry season, September and August. They're currently blooming right now. Anyway, comment after comment of people stating that they are seeing things flower out of season or negative impacts coming from not having the normal cold, mitigating beetles and bugs and those types of things. So I just thought that was interesting. We're going to see more and more of this as the wrong kinds of creatures thrive, the kinds that are pests, that do damage, that are invasive, and we'll continue to see the native plants start to struggle as their normal climate and ecosystems fail. Okay, moving on from there, let's get into this this actuary report. This came from the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries at the University of Exeter. And for anyone who does not know what an actuary is or have a good understanding, I'm going to read a quick definition. So an actuary is a professional with advanced mathematical skills who deals with the measurement and management of risk and uncertainty. These risks can affect both sides of the balance sheet and require asset management, liability management, and valuation skills. When I think of actuaries, I think most often of insurance. They are, you know, assessing future risk to determine the viability and cost needs for different insurance products. But the same can be said of different financial institutions, financial planning, government planning. There's all sorts of roles where actuaries can thrive. And so in this case, again, this is from the University of Exeter, and this report that they release each year is assessing risk for the future based specifically on climate change and other compounding contributors of that risk. So interesting report, about 37 pages long. I'll read through some of the key findings, and then we're going to look at the really important numbers. So key findings, here's some critical observations. Number one, we are part of the Earth system, which we depend on. There's a bunch of sub-bullets here I'm not going to read. I'll link to this report so you can read through the details. Number two, the stability of the Earth system is threatened. Number three, unmitigated climate change and nature-driven risks have been hugely underestimated. Four, Paris Agreement goals were not informed by realistic risk assessment. They implicitly accept high risk of crossing tipping points. Five, global risk management practices for policymakers are inadequate. We have accepted much higher levels of risk than is broadly understood. So they've kind of just created a little logical sequence of statements there, basically saying that we rely on the Earth and Earth systems. Those Earth systems are getting messed up. We have not done enough to prevent that, and that leads to much future risk. How much future risk, might you ask? Well, there's 37 pages of information here going through that risk. I am going to skip down to page 32, which is titled Appendix 1, Risk Impact Matrix, and they have different rating scales for the amount of impact, ranging from limited up to extreme. And each of those comes with a, you know, different set of GDP loss and the likelihood of that GDP loss, as well as human mortality and the likelihood of human mortality at different temperatures of increase in the climate. It also talks about, you know, in those cases, what would happen to nature and societally. I'm just going to read through a couple of these. We'll ignore the limited and severe because it gets worse than that. The worst three they have listed here are decimation, catastrophic, and extreme. So essentially on a scale from 1 to 5, decimation is right in the middle. It's a 3. It says we reach this level of destruction if global warming is limited to 2 degrees Celsius by 2050. Now, look, we've talked about this so much in the past and in the recent past, the direction that we're headed from a temperature perspective. One important thing to note is that when they talk about these numbers, 2 degrees C, they are talking about the 25-year average, usually. According to that average, we have not quite yet breached 1.5, even though in individual years, we most certainly have. Now, I take issue with this, and I think many do, and I hope that this starts to change. A 25-year average is such a long term to look over. And when things are happening at an exponential rate, the impact of what's happening today, which is being brought down by, you know, the results from 25 years ago, does not adequately, I think, express the level of damage that can be expected. If the temperature spikes in individual years to 3 degrees, and yet our 25-year average is still showing 1.8 because 15 of those years were from 2010 to 2025, but now we're in 2030 or 2035 and the temperature is just through the roof, there are going to be impacts that are not going to be the same as if we reached that same degree of temperature linearly. The exponential nature of it makes it so that the current impacts are more severe. And so that makes reports like this a little bit difficult perhaps to always understand and trust around the numbers. It's part of, you know, I believe why modeling can be so confusing. But we're going to go based off of that. So global warming limited to 2 degrees Celsius by 2050. It says that several climate tipping points would be triggered. From the perspective of GDP losses, it talks about over $10 trillion in annual losses. And on the human mortality side of things, over 800 million deaths. It shows a greater than 10% chance of that occurring. On the catastrophic, so a 4 out of 5, this would happen at 2 degrees Celsius or more by 2050. So saying we didn't limit it to 2 degrees or below, we breached the 2-degree point by 2050. Now we're talking about a high number of climate tipping points, partial tipping cascade, over 25% chance of 2 billion deaths or greater. So we're talking about a quarter of the current population dying away and having a greater than 25% chance of that. Lastly, at 3 degrees Celsius or more, this is a 5 out of 5. This is extreme. It says this would be 3 degrees Celsius or more by 2050, multiple climate tipping points triggered, tipping cascade, a greater 50% chance of more than 4 billion deaths, half of the current population dead, and greater than a 50% chance of that occurring, with GDP losses being well over 50%. On the nature and societal side of things for that one, it says breakdown of several critical ecosystem services and Earth systems, high level of extinction of higher order life on Earth. For societal, it says significant socio-political fragmentation worldwide and or state failure with rapid, enduring, and significant loss of capital and systems identity, frequent large-scale mortality events. And this is the world that I think we're headed into. Will we be at a 25-year average of 3C by 2050? Perhaps not. It will much depend on what these next 25 years look like. Right now, we're sitting, you know, on an annual basis between 1.5 and 1.6%. James Hansen projects that we'll hit 1.7 in this next year's El Nino. And we've seen an increase of about 0.36 per decade so far. That will also likely accelerate. Anyway, that's all to say that I feel fairly confident that we will not limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius by 2050. That number 3 with 800 million deaths is not likely to be met. Projections I've seen show that 2 degrees Celsius is probably more likely between 2035 and 2040. And then from there, really, it's anybody's guess as to how rapid is the acceleration, what are the models missing in regards to tipping points into cascading failures. I think that anyone that tries to tell you with certainty what that will look like is lying. But at the very least, then, according to this chart, we are looking at least a 25% chance or greater of at least 2 billion deaths, and very possibly and very likely even more than that. One last thing I want to kind of hit on with this here, and that I think is not quite talked about enough in the collapse conversation, is who this is primarily going to impact. Again, there's no certainty of what the future will look like. We are seeing collapse play out today in many regions of the world. We are seeing political impacts of collapse play out in many parts of the world today. All that said, those who are going to bear the brunt of the impact of climate change and collapse, I think breaks down into two different camps, right? One is there's this sort of obvious situation in which developed countries hold so much power, political power, military power, economic power. And if control or power was going to be asserted, that it could be done by these nations and that the world's poor would likely have to deal with an outsized impact from climate change. If we're talking about 4 billion deaths, right? If we're talking about half of the world population, the reality is that it will most likely be the world's poor that make up the majority of those numbers. This is not a racist statement. This is not a statement for me saying that I want it to be that way. This is not a statement for me saying that it should be that way, of course, in any way at all. It's just a it's just a reality check. Nearly half of the world's people today live on less than $7 a day. That's $200 a month. Meanwhile, 10% of people live off of less than $2.15 a day, right? $60 a month. These are the people that will not be able to react with flexibility in many cases to a warming climate, a rapid shift in local climate that changes the way that they do their farming and the food that's available in their local markets, and the inability to react to a sudden loss of fresh water, to extreme heat, which they aren't able to mitigate with air conditioning. These are the people that will be affected by mass migrations, because they also happen to be the people that live in the parts of the world that will be most affected by the impacts of climate. The parts of the world that are more rapidly being affected by all of these cascading impacts. And what I absolutely abhor about this fact is that so many in the developed countries, just based on the direction that we're headed, will turn a blind eye to that fact. I have thought before about the devastating effects of losing 100 million people or several hundred million people, but then realizing that if it happened in a nation far away, we could lose 5% or 10% of the population overnight, and so many people in this world would not bat an eye, may not even notice. We're seeing these wild events taking place throughout the world already, in which, yes, maybe there's not 100 million deaths, but there is terrible devastation and injustice, and we're already able to so easily turn a blind eye from it. I don't think that changes just because the number goes up. If 300 million people die in sub-Saharan Africa, but that doesn't change the way that my neighbor lives, right? If it doesn't change the way that I am able to go to the grocery store, if it doesn't change the way that somebody's 401k continues to climb, will they notice? Will they care? And will their caring matter? Maybe they will be devastated by that, right? I will be devastated by that. But what can I do? And so we'll carry on and we'll just keep living. Now, on the other side of that thought is that we will be impacted in developed countries, likely not in the same way or to the same degree, but there's also vulnerabilities in developed countries, right? We talk about this often, especially at the beginning of the podcast, with trading independence for convenience. We stand to fall pretty hard, right? If in the Western world or in the developed countries, all of this time building up convenience, if that convenience goes away and we lose our independence, we've already lost our independence, but if we're not able to take care of ourselves, then at that point, when the system fails us, we have that much further to fall. And so, you know, one of the big questions that you have as someone living in a developed country is, to what degree am I going to feel that impact? To what degree is the system going to be impacted by the cascading climate failures? Can the Western world or can developed countries look at it so callously from a macro scale and say it doesn't matter if half of the world dies as long as it doesn't affect our system? And can they realistically expect that it won't? There's all these different versions of the future when I try and think realistically about what might happen. And again, I hate to say it so callously, but it's the reality of things. And thinking about that future and, you know, my own place in it and understanding where I'm at and what that means, there's this sort of version of the future that I see in which, just like the billionaires describe, you know, we've talked about Curtis Yarvin and those who talk about this utopian, their version of a utopian future in which only the, you know, most productive of society in their views are the ones that remain, those who produce, who contribute to economic growth, and the rest don't matter. In their view, is it okay if the world population decreases by 50% or 60% or 90%? So long as the ones that they deem worthy remain? And can our systems survive that? I don't enjoy thinking of a future in which, you know, 10% of society or 20% of society remains, in which the wealthy has allowed 80% of the world's poorest to die off so that that 10 or 20% can continue to live in relative luxury. It brings about many dystopian movies and novels. And, you know, you think of things like Elysium or The Hunger Games or Altered Carbon, or there's a Netflix show called 3%. Just all these ideas of basically this future in which there is a wealthy few who have separated themselves and live together in relative luxury. And then you have the impoverished who live in absolute squalor. And every time I watch one of these shows, I think, man, it feels like we're so narrowed in, right? You think of the Hunger Games, and it feels like the population of that place, 12 districts in basically what's left of the entire United States. And every time they go from one district to another, it feels like the relative populations that you see there are so low. And I think, what about the rest of the world? Where's everybody else? And then I realize, well, maybe there isn't an everyone else. Maybe there are small pockets of humanity spread throughout the world. And, you know, in the 3%, that takes place in Brazil. And maybe in Brazil, there's the wealthy survivors that are able to gather together and stay in one place. While, yes, there are still millions of impoverished, the wealthy don't need to care about them anymore. Or in the Hunger Games, again, which takes place in the U.S., well, where's the rest of the world? We don't hear about what's happened in Europe and what's happened in Africa and Asia. And maybe similar things are playing out in each of those. And maybe in some areas, people have simply ceased to exist. Is that a world that those who are in control and who will fight to stay in control are okay with? And maybe it doesn't matter what anyone's okay with, because what's going to happen is what's going to happen. Anyway, I know this is a rant, and I'm sorry for that. But I think it's just shifted my thoughts a little bit around what the future looks like, in that I used to kind of picture us all going through it together, right? That when systems start to fail and water becomes so scarce and food becomes so scarce, that we'll all experience that collapse together. And that if 50% of the world ceases to exist, that 50%, at least I used to think it would be much more evenly distributed now than I believe that it probably will be. Anyway, happy to hear your thoughts. Reach out, let me know how you see that playing out from a demographics perspective. I'm grateful you're here. Enjoy the rest of your week.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.